All right, welcome everyone. So it's great to see everyone online. Great to see everyone here in person. Those online, you can take a look in the room and see we have a pretty good crowd. So thank you all for coming, whatever format works for you. And welcome to anyone who might be new tonight. So my name is Tim Guile, one of the guiding teachers here at Seattle Insight. And tonight we'll do a meditation for about 40 minutes. I'll offer a talk on the ox herding pictures and then have a chance for some questions and answers. And we'll take a break about after the meditation, so about 4:45. All right, so we are continuing with this ox herding exploration. I know Tori Salah talked last week about the ox herding, the seeing the ox, this next third picture in the series. And so I'll have my own take on it and lead us through the rest of the month. So I'm going to just turn off my video so you can see the image while I read the poem. As you listen to the poem, just kind of take in the image, take in the visual of it. And those online, you could, maybe I could get highlighted, or those in person can see it. I hear the song of the nightingale. The sun is warm, the wind is mild. Willows are green along the shore. Here, no bull can hide. What artist can draw that massive head, those majestic horns? So let's explore this verse, this image, and kind of see what it has to do with our practice, with our lives, really, as well as our Dharma practice. Now, I'm going to divide this into three sections of this verse. The first section is, I hear the song of the nightingale. The sun is warm, the wind is mild, and the willows are green along the shore. The second section is, here no bull can hide. And the third section, what artist can draw that massive head, those majestic horns? So this first section, I hear the song of the nightingale. For those of us here in person, there was a bird serenading us throughout the meditation. And I thought that was so fitting for this verse, just how it calls us out into nature, helps us orient into the present moment through that. I hear the song of the nightingale. The sun is warm. The wind is mild. Willows are green along the shore. When I read this verse, I thought it was a bit surprising, considering what we've been doing the last 2 months. You know, the first month is just this kind of hopeless searching for the ox, looking this way and that way, getting lost in the woods, not sure where to go. And last month, seeing that the ox, the traces of the ox, seeing the footprints for the first time. It seemed like this picture, this verse would have a lot of excitement, a lot of elation. Finally, we've seen what we've been searching for. And the ox representing true nature, really as perceived outside of ourselves. So this is an interesting, surprising verse, the way it starts with these three elements of really opening our senses to nature. To that frustration of searching for the ox, the desperation, the yearning of the first picture, the finding the footprints, the discovering the traces, and become more and more obvious as Tuareg explored last month, becoming easier to track, easier to perceive, but not seeing the ox itself, getting close to that object of that search. And then now this picture, we actually see the ox, or at least the second half of the ox. But instead of the excitement, the payoff of all this effort, this anticipation, the celebration, there's this verse of calmness. Instead of like, there's the ox, I found it at last. It's like there's this, listen to the stillness. Look at the beauty of nature. You know, feel that breeze. I hear the song of the nightingale. The sun is warm. The wind is mild. Willows are green along the shore. So it's really a shifting from our almost myopic the blinders on, the myopic obsession focus just where is that ox? Where is it? Where is it located? Where's the traces of the ox? Searching here and there, seeing the tracks, being like a bloodhound trying to sense where that track leads, that total focus. And it's a shift from that obsessive focus on the ox into nature. And you can see this through line of nature throughout these verses, throughout these images. In some ways, this foreshadows what happens to the ox later on in the series. But the ox isn't mentioned at all in these first three lines. I find that kind of surprising and interesting. So what does that teach us? What is the teaching from that? Because some of the power of these images and these verses, it reaches us in different ways than just the normal, you know, speaking. The images have a power to them that can sink in and work on us over time. So first, of course, there's the opening of our senses, you know, opening of our hearing, our sensing with the wind, the temperature, the sight, seeing those willows, hearing the bird song. And this is such a helpful thing to remember, just in a very fundamental part of our practice, is that when we start to become so focused and contracted around something, whether it's something that's painful in our lives, something that maybe is traumatic that's bubbling up in our system, maybe it's a difficulty that we're having in our lives, or maybe there's an obsession in our practice. I really want to see something. I really want to focus on something. And our minds become so contracted around that. You lose sight of everything else. Sorry, I have to still figure out this mic here. And this is actually an important technique to remember if we are dealing with something difficult, something traumatic. When I went through my teacher training, one of the things I learned was how to work with trauma. And the way that trauma tends to happen, it tends to really draw all our attention to the intensity of it, into the memory of it, the physical sensations, the emotions, and we lose sight of what's actually present or brought back to that old time. And learning to intentionally refocus on something in this moment, which is pleasant, which is actually non-threatening, that's actually, we perceive it as pleasing, starts to rebalance our nervous system. We can do this in other ways, and even if we're not into experiencing a trauma release, just when we're dealing with something difficult, is to have a broadness of our attention. Even right now, as you're listening, as you're practicing this evening, can your attention be broader than just whatever you might be seeing? Can you see something broader, like the backdrop of the woods out there, or even just feeling the temperature of the air on your skin? So in the midst of this difficulty you might be struggling with, listening to the birds, listening to the breath of the breeze, feel the temperature. This becomes this wider quality of awareness. And this is very helpful when you're dealing with something that's difficult. Because when it's difficult, we tend to contract around. Now the Buddha spoke of this in this way. There's a section of a sutta called the Rose Apple Tree. Now this is the stage of his awakening practice. You know, for 6 years, he strived, you know, harder and harder to attain awakening. He studied, you know, profound techniques of concentration, deep meditative states, and just put his whole heart into it. And then he started to really go into this, was kind of popular at that time, is this kind of self-mortification, really starving your body, really punishing your body. So this is where this sutta comes in. That having driven his body near to death, the Buddha reflected, I thought, whenever a monk or a Brahmin or a nun has felt in the past or will feel in the future or feels now painful, racking, piercing, feeling dirt due to striving, it can equal this, but not exceed it. Because he's just realizing that he's doing what's the maximum for a human being. But by this grueling penance, I have obtained no distinction higher than the human state, worthy of the noble one's knowledge and vision. So even though he's been striving, putting his whole heart into it, really pushing him, his body beyond its limits, he realizes this is not going the direction that he wants to go. It's not going toward his liberation. Sorry, excuse me for a second. So as I was saying, he was pushed himself to such an extreme, you know, he was really close to death. But he realized it wasn't going the way he wanted. You know, so think back to that first picture, the Oxford pictures of how we're searching something which is outside of ourselves, or at least we think it's outside of ourselves. So he says, might there be another way to enlightenment? And this is where this first three lines come in. I thought of a time when my father was working and I was sitting in the cool shade of a rose apple tree, quite secluded from sensual desire, secluded from unwholesome things I had entered upon and abode in the first meditation, which is accompanied by thinking and exploring with happiness and pleasure born of seclusion. I thought, might that be the way to enlightenment? Then following up on that memory, there came the recognition of that this was the way to an enlightenment. So he realized that the striving was actually getting in his way. It was actually holding him back. And so this first verse speaks to that. Just, wow, we hear something we've been seeking and seeking, and suddenly we see it. But really what we're seeing is our true nature. And we relax our attention. We actually hear the birds. We actually sense the temperature of the air. We feel the soft caress of the breeze. We see the beauty of the willow trees in the distance. So in this way, this first few verses is, you know, teaching about struggle in our practice. Because the ox, representing our true nature, it's not outside of ourselves. It's what we truly are. And yet we project it as something out there. You know, so this is kind of the whole joke of these pictures and so much of our spiritual practice is that we search and search externally for that which is already inside of us. So thinking more about it as uncovering, a revealing, than an attaining. So this is teaching on struggle. Something which is outside of us, which actually isn't. And this question, or these first three verses, for those of you who are old timers around here, Rodney Smith used to talk about the vertical question, a question that would bring us from the horizontal realm, this realm of attaining, of time, of me getting there, of my own insufficiency and making myself more perfect or more something in the future, to this vertical question drops us right into the middle of right here. And he would, you know, question could be something like, where is there stillness in this moment? Where is there love in this moment? You know, where is there peace in this moment? Where is the ox? Where is the true nature in this moment? A question that would cut through our normal striving mind. So it becomes a change of perspective, a change of orientation. And in this way, nature just opens up to us. It becomes very vivid, very accessible. Because really what's happening is that we are open to the nature that's always present. We are the one who opens. So these first three verses, these first three lines, I should say, teach that. Teach that quality of the coming back and releasing our struggle. Coming into this present moment. And this way, this is a very pivotal image and verse in this series because it does teach something that is taught in a more profound way later on. Because there's always this dynamic tension between struggle, effort, and the release of that struggle. And how do those work together? And throughout there's this striving, this going towards something, and there's the release of that. Because we realize it's actually what we're seeking is within us. So the second section of this verse, no bull can hide. no bull can hide. Now this one, again, the true nature is represented by the ox or the bull. Now the first picture, the first verse, you know, remember 2 months ago, we were sure, we exhausted all possibilities looking for happiness, looking for peace. We started to understand what roads did not lead to freedom. And I went up this gully, went up this mountain, and none of them I found that ox. None of them I found that sense of freedom, where that lied. In the second picture, we started to get a sense of where that freedom lied by the seeing those images of the footprints. In this picture, we actually start to glimpse that freedom. We recognize it by what it's not. You know, through our striving, we see, oh, it's not this way, not that way. And so it's what we've been searching for endlessly. It can't hide. It has no other place to go. So I think this is an interesting thing to unpack a little bit. Because does it mean that we have the ox cornered? Like we've kind of corralled it into a place it can't escape from us? Or does it mean something else? Another translation talks about the ox having no place to turn in the brambles. No place to turn in the brambles is another translation of this verse. So you kind of can't go this way or can't go that way. And to me, that brings up this middle path between these worldly winds. You know, these worldly winds we talked about last year of praise and blame, of gain and loss, fame and disrepute, and pleasure and pain. Because the struggle itself, the struggle that, this is an important piece, that the struggle itself is really driven by what's called tanha, or thirst, or hunger. Really the thirst to become, the thirst to not become, the thirst to somehow fulfill and ease our insufficiency, our lack, by becoming something different. Becoming something better, something more, or becoming something less than we want to be, avoiding something in ourselves. This is really the second noble truth of this whole, what creates that origination of suffering. Now, if you start to look at it in this way, that the ox, the true nature is like we start to realize, okay, what's that nature revealed by when we're not thirsting, if we're not hungering, not trying to become something or not become something. Ajahn Buddhadasa talked about everyday nibbana or nirvana. Now, nirvana, sorry, I'm a little tongue-tied with this mask on, simply means extinguishing, blowing out. That's what it means in the common language of Pali. It's like taking a candle and blowing out the flame. In the context of Dharma, it means the blowing out of this thirst to constantly, that constant restless motion. Have you ever noticed that? That, you know, you could be, sometimes you notice this when you're working and you're getting ready to go on vacation and you're so excited, then I can relax. And you get on vacation and you actually relax? Is there a sense of like, oh, I have to keep doing something. I want to make sure I see all those sights. I want to make sure I, you know, get that experience, see this and that. There's this kind of constant restless movement. If you start to look more closely, it does have a quality of kind of hunger, of thirst to it. They were constantly trying to become something. I want to become better than I am now. I want to become, avoid what I've the painful sense of who I am. I want to somehow eliminate that or not become that. Both of those are the same thing, just different sides of that. So he talked about the everyday nibbana, that this constant movement is what catches our attention. That's what we focus our energy on. But yet right now in this moment, if you look around the room or your environment, there's so many things here that don't elicit that thirst. They don't elicit any, like, I want more of that. I want less of that. That me doesn't depend upon that. There's this kind of natural coolness, the natural lack of of wanting or not wanting of that experience. And that's what you talked about, this everyday nibbana. It's almost like we ignore that because it doesn't catch our attention. It's not interesting. Like the feeling tones, Vedana, pleasant, unpleasant, or neither pleasant or unpleasant. That third one, usually we just check out, we ignore it, we don't pay attention to it. We find it boring. But if we start to relax into that neutrality, there's actually a deep peace that arises from that because we're not selfing in relationship to it. We're not creating that sense of self that ultimately is going to experience suffering in relationship to that neutralness, that everyday nibbana. We miss how often that is, how many moments in our life in each day are like that, because we're focusing on the ones that charge us up, that makes us anxious, that makes us want to do something with. So our meditative practice, our daily life practice, it starts to really come forth when we start to see, often through trial and error, what creates more suffering, what creates less suffering. And so then our true nature starts to become more like, is like being no place for the bull to move, because there's brambles on this side, there's brambles on this side. There's suffering if I go toward craving and wanting in a way that reinforces the self. There's suffering if I go toward aversion in a way that reinforces the self. So this is through line throughout these pictures of this struggle, I cannot speak tonight, contrasted with the struggle. Release the struggle, contrasted with the struggle itself. So we have to find, this is where it becomes so interesting in our practice, because if we just say, okay, I'm not supposed to have any effort, not to have any goals, then I just kind of sit on the couch following my impulses, watching Netflix or whatever you like to do, and you just kind of go through life that way. On the other hand, if you get so contracted around, spiritual practice, it can also lead us away. To try to find where's that balance. This is one of the deeper teachings of this series of pictures. So one of the koans, or one of the things we need to learn as people in this path, is how do we experience the pleasure and pain, the gain and loss, fame, disrepute, blame and shame, blame and praise, without selfing around it, without going into tanha around it. Can we experience pleasure? We can experience enjoyment without having to contract the sense of self around it. Can we experience pain, difficulty, loss, without contracting around the sense of self around it? Right? So when I hear this, the bull has no place to go. There's brambles on this side and then brambles on the outside, is really starting to see through our wisdom, through our understanding, where that kind of spot is, that sweet spot is between those two. And sometimes it can feel like it's like a knife edge. We're just barely teetering from one to the other. But actually, once we start to, the deeper practice, the deeper way of understanding this, it becomes, there's such a shift of perspective that we don't have that. We really orient toward that selfing. That's the key piece there. So I don't know if that makes sense. We can explore that in the questions and answers. But that's the question. Can we experience something without creating that sense of me around it? It's not the thing itself. It's the selfing around it. That's pointing toward that true nature of what we really are outside of that contraction of me, of I. And the final verse is, what artist can draw that massive head, those majestic horns? This verse, you're actually looking at the ox. This time we're actually really seeing the ox. And it's not, the whole picture isn't shown. We're just seeing the body of it. The head itself is obscured. This is pointing toward how our true nature, what we really are, is beyond concept, is beyond words, beyond ideas. Like in Islam, it's, you know, prohibited to have an image of Muhammad, you know, because perhaps part of that is that the reason for that is that it takes us, it makes something which is inherently sacred and mysterious and beyond thought, it contracts it into this idea and this image. So we start to relate to that image instead of the essence of that. What artist can draw that massive head, those majestic horns? Because once we start to relate to the image, we're no longer relating to the mystery, the actual unfolding. And as these pictures go on, you can see the next couple pictures, the next one in particular, when we're really struggling with the ox, trying to tame the ox, we're starting to relate to it, you know, as, again, something outside of us that has to be contracted. While this picture, there's this sweetness of just simply seeing the ox and at the same time seeing the beauty of nature, the stillness of nature. They're hearing the song of the nightingale. The sun is warm, the wind is mild. Willows are green along the shore. Here no bull can hide. What artist can draw that massive head, those majestic horns? So I think I've come to the end of what I wanted to say. A little quick that time, but that's all right. Let's just sit quietly for a few moments, and then I want to talk about the homework, and then we'll have a chance for, you know, hopefully there's some questions we can really engage and flesh out this verse and this image. So just sitting quietly for a few moments. They hear the song of the nightingale. The sun is warm, the wind is mild. Willows are green along the shore. Here no bull can hide. What artist can draw that massive head, those majestic horns? All right, so thank you, Dara. Just posted the homework for those online, and hopefully you got a copy of it. So the homework I'll read it for you is that when you find yourself strongly seeking or obsessing over something spiritual or worldly, okay, practice opening your senses to what is immediately present. Okay, so notice when the mind contracts around something. Okay, could it be something very spiritual? You're like, okay, I really want to understand God. I want to understand silence. I want to understand my true nature. Or it could be that I really want to have that new toy or whatever it might be. Okay, just notice that when you find that quality in your mind, when you're obsessing, you're yearning, you're seeking, practice shifting for a moment to opening your senses to what is immediately present. Because you'll find that the thing that you're often seeking, it's by nature outside of yourself. It's out there. It's in the future. Maybe it's across the room, whatever it might be. And we just kind of lose sight of everything else in that seeking. So the invitation is to practice, okay, what else is present right here, right now? I mean, literally notice the hue of the green on the chairs, the play of the light along the legs, the quality of the light hitting the ceiling. You know, the mysterious shadow and the lights, the nice hue of the sky outside. Can you actually feel the temperature touching your skin? Can you feel your body touching the cushion? What sounds are present right now in this moment? And as you do that, start to notice, how does this shift your perspective in relationship to that thing that you've been seeking? Notice how that thing itself suddenly has the scene in context of everything else that's around you and present. And start to notice, is it possible to continue that seeking without engaging in that tanha, that craving that leads to becoming? Okay, so tanha is that thirst, that sense that I need this to be able to be something, to become something, to become a sense of me, a sense of who I hope to be, to avoid what I think I am. Both sides, becoming, the hunger to become, hunger not to become, just different sides of the same coin. But how does this transform the sense of you? So I encourage you to take this at really a daily life practice into, you know, wherever you might be. You start to become curious about that. Start to notice that obsessive quality, that seeking quality, and see if you can shift to noticing what else is present and how that might transform that seeking in itself. All right, hopefully that makes sense. All right, so now we have some time for any questions or comments you'd like to have. So those online, you can probably best if you raised your hand, your virtual hand, not your real hand. And those here in the room, you could do the same thing, but you can raise your real hand. If you're here, real hand. If you're there, virtual hand. Yes.
It's actually more of a question about the verses. I just feel the third section in particular, the what artists could capture, the head, the horns.
Yes.
I'm not familiar with the series of pictures, so I don't know like its style, whether it's meant to be more descriptive or more like a lesson or something.
Right,
like that.
Right.
But it seems very particular to me that we can, it's talking about the head and the horns when we can only see the rear. Mm. And my initial reaction to that was that it's an admonition to say, you know, here we are, we're in this third stage, suddenly we're opening up, we're paying attention to what's there. It seemed to me likely to be saying, don't think about the head and the horns. All you've got is the rear end. So just look at the rear end. We don't even know that there's a head and horns. I mean, maybe you'll come around the tree and it'll have like a body of head of a chicken or something like that.
Right,
that's
yeah.
All there is. There's just the back half of the cup. So it seemed to me so particularly like giving you the rear end of the cow and then saying, having this sort of rhetorical question, like, you know, who could imagine the head? Who could
right.
The horns? Whether it might just be sort of a reminder to stay with what we've got and not to then go off, you know, distract yourself with what you haven't seen.
Yes, yeah, I think that's a great observation that let me put in my back. That's what we love about these images and pictures, because we get to find our own way through them. And I think that's, you know, I think, you know, as I work with them each month, it's going to change. You know, one week I see it this way, next week another way. And I think that's a great way to see it, is that, yeah, the verse is talking about this head, but it's not actually portrayed. And that is kind of strange, isn't it? You know, and yet we've been seeking this ox, looking for this ox, and we see something, but we don't, the head, the thing really orient to, you know, that's imagined right now. So I think that's a great way to come, it's a reminder to come back into, okay, what's right in front of you? Right in front of you, here's the hind end and the leg and the tail. And we don't know what the rest of it looks like. And it's a reminder, even when we see it, okay, how do we actually keep coming back to that innocence, that freshness of observation? And so much of our practice is learning to peel away the layers of projection we put on the world. You know, the way we say, okay, you are this way. And we just see the category of being that we've created versus the actual person themselves. How we hold ourselves in that. It's really, we kind of imprison the world. You know, it certainly helps us to understand if we want to, you know, catch the bus, we don't try to jump on a tree. You know, it helps us to know those differences. But it's also very limiting. That's why the Buddha talked about how we create the whole world through our perceptions, through our experience, and how we can really free us from the world by learning to directly see experience. So much of the practice as a meditator. So thank you for sharing that. All right. Anyone in the line have anything they'd like to share or offer? All right, Bonnie. Let's see. Do they have permission to unmute, Cheryl?
Yeah, I'm unmuted.
Great.
I guess it bounces off of that last question, or all of what we've seen so far. It just kind of dawned on me with that last sentence. They're searching for this ox, but they already know what the ox looks like. Otherwise, that last sentence wouldn't be there. That it's not an unknown. It's not a mystery. It's not, you know, like, how could they know that there is majestic horns with something that they're searching for? There has to be a sense of some deeper innate knowing of what they're looking for to even be able to describe it. That's just the thought that popped up as he was speaking. You don't know what the head looks like. Yes, they do. They described it beautifully. So how does that play into all of this? Because there is sort of this unknown and mystery, but yet it is known. Otherwise, you wouldn't have that description.
Great. Thank you, Bonnie. Yeah, I think that's a good observation also. It's like there's... we can, you know, describe what the ox looks like. You know, there's this image of it. So there is this inner knowing. Again, the ox represents this true nature, this inner nature of who we are. And there's also this process of it becoming more and more revealed, more and more understood. That, you know, first we're searching for it, period. Then we start to see its footprints. Then we start to see part of it. And the next time we actually see it full on and we're, you know, learning how to try to tame it, to try to, you know, master it. And so there's this, you know, more and more intimacy, more and more depth of understanding what it is, what it looks like, and really making it our own is part of this practice. And there's this inner, you know, there's a way that we already know what it is, but there also we're kind of reminding yourself of what it is. So thank you, Bonnie. All right. Anyone here in person like to share anything? Yes, Cuba.
Just lift the whole thing.
Yes, that's great.
I found myself thinking about from behind, like you were saying, and if I'm in a big wilderness area or even a big pasture, I'm coming up behind a four-legged creature. Like I've done that with horses. I don't want to rush. And one of the practices, I guess, is I love how the artist, the poet started with noticing nature, because that takes me into a different state of, like, instead of, and now I've got you, it's like, oh, wait. The willows, the birds, the creature. Here we all are together. And then I slow down and I'm really seeing it there without rushing into. That's where my mind went.
Yeah, beautiful. Yeah, so the sense of slowing down, of being, you know, being aware of your surroundings, being, you know, connected to your surroundings, even though this is something that you've been seeking, you know, this very intently, and how that, you know, there's this patience, there's this ease, there's a timelessness with it too, that picture invites us to see. And, you know, if those of you who, you know, like to go out and see, you know, wild animals, it's not like you suddenly see that picture like it's on the National Geographic. You see a tail, or you see a glimpse of something, and there's a lot of patience as it just slowly reveals itself more and more to your, to you. Thank you, Cubba. All right, Lauren.
Well, Tim, I thought when you were talking about beware of becoming too contracted around an aspect of practice or emotional suffering or trauma and to pull back and widen, and that that was a really practical and wise advice that I could use. And this picture, when I have been reflecting on it, reminded me of a time when I first came to, started at Sims, and I was, came because I was really suffering and I was very contracted around an emotional fear and trying to control a situation and using every technique I knew of, you know, prayer and psychoanalysis and just everything I could think of to ease my suffering. And I can remember, so I was weighted down, and I can remember doing walking meditation at one of my first weekend retreats. And it was so in contrast to anything that I had tried before, and I didn't see how it could be of any help, really. But I can remember being weighted down with this emotional contracting and stepping and lifting and stepping. And it reminded me of the nature that you're talking about here and the ability to go beyond. You know, it wasn't thinking, it wasn't the usual ways that I responded to emotional suffering. It was just totally different. And I had this feeling that, you know, there's the back of the ox. There was something about the very solidity of that practice that was so different than the suffering, that emotional suffering. And I didn't know how it was calming, but it wasn't immediately calming. I mean, I was really still, I could feel that pain, but there was just something about doing that walking that was so not emotion. And it was natural, you know, it was the nature, it was an aspect of nature, and it was my body. And it was a really big, you know, I associate it with that ox because it was something I could really sense. Oh, there's something here. And there were no words to talk about it, but I could just feel it. It was very, very reassuring. And, you know, it had that friendliness of the setting of this particular verse. I still get a lot from that too. You know, it hasn't left, so very valuable.
Yes, thank you, Lauren, for sharing that. Because yeah, these ox herding pictures can have a very practical exploration of how we practice and how we, you know, we first learn to meditate. We're kind of minds going all over the place. Sometimes we're dealing with some very, you know, specific thing in our lives that just grips our minds and our emotions, and we're trying to, well, how do I find my breath? How do I find my feet? That's like the first picture, you know, of just like, okay, where is this meditation? And I'm looking this way and that way. The second image is, so you start to have some sense of that. And then now we start to go into that, actually, how do we make contact with that present moment? You know, something as simple as the foot touching, one step. That's like seeing the ox. Like the ox is that connection with, is really, you know, when we're really truly meditating, we're really present. We're not influencing. We're not changing. We're not thinking. We're there. You know, that's another way we could define what the ox is. So it can be a very, it doesn't have to be this far out esoteric you know, teaching can be very practical in that way. And I think also it comes to mind is, once we start to learn the ABCs or the basics of meditation, we start to learn to also not only track our breath, but actually track the mindfulness itself, the quality of that mindfulness. So what I mean by that is sometimes our mindfulness is a little heavy-handed, or it's too tense, or it's too, you know, locked up. Because like the kind of emotional difficulty you were describing, I think we all can relate to that. When we're really, it's gripping us, our attention is right there. It's like, it's like the problem is that we're too attending to it. We can't have any respite from it. It just draws our attention right in there. You know, so our mindfulness is no longer mindfulness. It's really this kind of locked in Velcro kind of attention. And so we start to sense that, okay, when is my attention like that? When is my attention becoming too rigid, too sticky, too locked in? And then we start to learn, how do we start to relax that in a way that the mindfulness becomes much more pliable, much more expansive? And a really important technique is this is a broadening our attention. So we're almost walking concurrently with something that might be emotionally charged, mentally charged, and something like the foot touching the grass, something like feeling the breath, listening to a bird song. And what it does is it takes our mindfulness from being that contracted quality to being much more broad. This is really how I work with difficulty, is I come into it personally, I'm talking myself personally, in a broad context. When I contract around, then it's I'm just lost in the struggle. If I'm also aware more or less equally with other things in my environment, suddenly that painful thing, it doesn't magically go away, but it becomes much more manageable, much easier to work with, much easier to have some access of skill around it, some access of compassion, some clarity. So yeah, thank you for sharing that, Lauren.
Thank you.
All right, let's just kind of go back and forth. Anyone here in the room like to share anything? All right, Cheryl, come on down.
You know, Tawiri was talking, I've been listening to talks about this picture for a week or so now. And Tawiri was talking about, you know, that we've all had an experience, you know, of this, you know, of finding the bull. We've all had this experience of something that, you know, of mindfulness playing out in our life, you know. Mm. And for me, you know, my example was last week was, you know, sometimes I forget that I've made an intention to practice noble silence or whatever. And then suddenly I remember, and that's my mindfulness coming. It's my mindfulness. So that's just a simple moment.
Right.
And I just made it when Kubba was talking about, you know, walking up on the horse and, you know, and you kind of stressing the, you know, the peacefulness of the scene and everything else. That's what allows the remembering. And I just made that connection with the picture. I wasn't really, you know, being kind of stuck in the brambles and all this, but I don't quite get that part. It's kind of like, well, I'm seeing it. I'm not feeling very stuck. So maybe that part is, well, maybe now I want to grasp it, or I don't know about that part. But anyway, I just love that image of being just quietly. It's a stillness. There's a stillness there that's already present. That you know, I normally don't have access to. Yeah. Anyway, just wanted to share that.
Great. Thank you, Cheryl. Yeah, that sense of stillness and quiet. Yeah, when we have access to that, then it's much easier to be mindful, or to remember our intentions, and to use, you know, wise speech and all those things, you know, just naturally comes up. But, you know, that's really the rub of life, is that so often it doesn't feel externally very quiet. And internally, it doesn't feel so quiet either. In fact, even really noisy, even if it's externally quiet. So how do we find access? How do we locate where that ox is? And that's something that, you know, I think over time, you know, through just sincere practice, through insights, through really diligence of noticing where we contract, where we struggle, where we lose our footing, and learning from those, you know, that starts to, we start to have this backlog of something starts to transform, that we become naturally more quiet, that actually our minds tend to naturally prefer that quiet. You know, that's kind of, we start to recognize that's more truly what we are. And so even in the midst of noise, you can start to still find that place of stillness. And so that's, and the way to practice that is to just seek it out. See, okay, so there's no stillness here at all, internally or externally. Okay, where is it? Because if it's true, just have this premise that maybe if it's always here, just covered up, that means I can always access it. I can at least have a taste of it. And there's the trick is, how do you find that taste? How do you find that point of access? And it's, unfortunately, you can't just figure out one way and it's always going to work for you. You know, find one way that works sometimes, and you have to find a different way, because our minds are constantly changing. Our life situation, our experiences are constantly changing. But we start to know more and more clearly, when am I seeing those footprints of the ox? When am I actually seeing the ox, at least part of it? You know, when do I actually see that? And when am I completely lost? We become more and more clear about those. And that becomes the guidance. You know, that's how we learn. So thank you, Cheryl. Okay, so I see Matt. Go ahead.
Yeah. Hi, Tim. Something I've been thinking about between this month's photo and the one last month is, like, there's some similarities, right, between, they're both kind of clues, like seeing the footsteps, seeing, like, the back of the ox. There's this common thread between them of, you know, kind of our first experiences of, like, seeing it, seeing evidence of it, and seeing it. I was just curious, like, I can tell they're different, but I was wondering what your take is on, like, what is the difference between, you know, seeing the footsteps of the ox versus our first experience of seeing the ox?
All right, so the difference between seeing the footprints versus actually seeing it in itself. Well, you know, just from a very kind of obvious standpoint, as I kind of feel into your question, you know, I might be walking in the woods and I see the footprints of an elk or a deer or even a coyote or something. And I realize, okay, that animal has passed through here. This animal is going from some place to another and I can maybe follow it. But I'm always kind of lagging behind where the animal actually is. But to actually see the animal right now, right present time, as it's making the steps, there's an immediacy to it. So I think that's a nice way to look at that, is that it's, you know, we kind of go from, if you look at the whole projection of these 10 pictures, the first one, we have this idea of the ox. We think it's around someplace and we don't know where it is. Then we actually start to see the footprints. We become more and more adept at seeing those footprints. They become, you know, as clear as our nose looking heavenward. And then there's the actually glimpsing the ox, actually seeing the ox itself, or at least the hind side of it, right? And then the next part, so it's becoming, you know, from something abstract to, okay, we're actually seeing the actual expression of it, what's left behind, to actually seeing it itself. And then the next picture, we start to actually grapple with that ox. We try to tame it. We're, you know, really struggling with it. And there's a process of becoming more and more intimate, connected to that ox. So we start to merge from this sense of me being outside of the ox to seeing the ox, to actually joining with the ox. And there's a point where we actually become unified with the ox. So there's this, you know, going home on the flute. There's just this, you and the ox are one and the same. And then it takes this really strange turn. It's like the ox is forgotten. You know, and so it's become such a part of us that we no longer see any sense of separation. Yeah, so it's part of that. That's how I would kind of hold that, is that becoming more and more intimate with it. Because, whether we hold, true nature is kind of, it can be a little bit of an abstract thing, but we could say understanding really the essence of our practice and understanding, really who and what we are. We usually start from this observation, this almost intellectual understanding of what it is. We're trying to find where that is. We try this and that. And then we start to, by trial and error, we start to see where that actually is. And then we start to relate to it. We start to become, we struggle with it. We try to regain it when it's lost. We try to make it change. And eventually we start to really become connected to it, one in the same in it. And eventually that connection becomes, we emerge so there's no separation. Yeah. So thank you, Matt. We've had a lot of time for questions, so we might be near the end, but just give pause. Okay, looks like Judith, go ahead.
Yeah, this week, this past couple of weeks, for some reason, I've had like a series of things falling apart, like computer, phone, it's just one thing after another. And so my focus has been very much on, okay, I've got to fix this. Okay, I've got to fix that. Okay, and I'm suddenly seeing all that in perspective of what we've been talking about, that I've just been constantly focused on, getting things fixed. And I've had periods like that before, like, why? Does all these things come in batches almost? I don't know that you can answer that, but is there something in my attention, something in my focus? I don't know. I don't know what the question is even, but.
Sure. So kind of part of your question is, why do things come in threes, or why do things come in batches? And is there, how much is it, us manifesting that through our, energy or whatnot?
Yeah.
I mean, one way to answer that is around karma. The karma teachings of the Buddha is karma means action, and actions have a certain fruition, a certain way that they manifest in the future. But the Buddha also was really clear that he said he wouldn't answer questions about karma because he said it was too complex for anyone to understand, just the interweavings of how things all line up. And because there's not only, whatever actions we did last week, there's actions we did 2 years ago when we were children, our conditioning. If you go into the cosmology of Buddhism, there's different lifetimes. So it's too complex to try to understand. But the important thing is, well, how do you meet this moment? How do you meet this with the as skillful action as you can? So, again, karma means action. So how do you relate to it with your mind, your body, your words in a way that is, basically has the potential for generating more positive outcomes? So basically being kind, being wise, being compassionate, being clear, all those things, ethical is the best way to do it. And, that's one way to answer your question. Another way is to, sometimes it's helpful to, take really, when I was in, I did group therapy for a couple of years, and we had these self-care contracts, like, I will not make, one of them was, I will not make myself sick, right? And so whenever I got a cold, I had to like understand, okay, why did I cause myself to get sick? And it's like, I just wanted to say, oh, I just got sick. But then I said, okay, well, I was, burning the candle at both ends. I was really stressed. I wasn't really dealing with this thing that I should have dealt with. And so I really took a radical sense of responsibility. So you might just notice, okay, how are you in your life right now? Are you feeling like you may be overextended? Are you doing this or that? And just, just kind of take that kind of inventory of your life. And sometimes it just things happen. You know, sometimes it's just a string of bad luck and you just meet it the best you can. Yeah. But I don't have any special mystical ways of explaining it, why some things fall apart and other times they don't. Just be thankful when they're going well and learn the best you can from when they're not. All right. Thank you, Judith. All right, Amber, I see you have your hand up. You'd like to go?
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Thanks for your talk tonight.
You're welcome.
I'm curious about the true nature and just what we mean when we say that, when you say that, and where that overlaps or intersects with bodhicitta, and how sometimes when in this practice it can become sort of a mental exercise, and maybe we talked about that with the focus, and when we contract and some of those things can feel mentally oriented. And I'm curious where we make contact with the heart and if our true nature is the same thing as the heart and what we find there. And that's what I'm curious about today.
Yes. Sorry. I'm muting and unmuting. So you don't get feedback from the speaker. Yeah. It's a really big question. It's an important question. You know, what is our true nature? How does it work? How does it relate to a heart mind? How does it relate to the heart itself? And it's one of those things that, you know, like the last line in this verse is like, you know, what artist can draw this massive head, those majestic horns? We could have said, you know, what verse could capture the essence of true nature? It's like we can kind of just point toward it. Because when true nature is really coming forth, it's like it does have this wordless quality. You know, it's something that's undefinable. And yet it's very clear what it is. It's, what I mean by that is like there's a level of connection. And so often we have taste of it. We have, you know, senses of it. And sometimes we're leading with our minds. Sometimes our hearts are leading with it. And sometimes things just open. You know, sometimes it's through deep practice, it's through insight. Sometimes it's through, you know, beauty in nature, you know, seeing a newborn baby. Sometimes it's being with someone who is dying and, you know, just seeing like suddenly things open such a, you know, it's like it's too big to hold with our normal contraction and something opens up. You know, so there's a sense of deep interconnection, of non-separation. And it's words, you know, don't adequately describe it. And so that's part of it, really the mystery of what that is and what it means to you personally. You know, what does that really show up as? And you start to, you know, when you start to become, have deeper connections with it, you start to see that it's not just your own personal one. It's something that we all share. You know, we start to see that, okay, this is the essence of really all things. So I'm kind of, you know, pointing vaguely towards, you know, at least the way I interpret true nature, but there's many ways to experience it and to open to it. Does that help, Amber?
Yeah, that helps. Thank you.
You're welcome. All right. Well, thank you all for your engaged questions and, you know, really brings out different elements of this topic as we all really explore it together. And really it is, you know, it's up to each one of us to explore it and see where has it come alive for us and to let it be a journey, you know, that takes different courses, different directions and naturally changes as our understanding changes. So next week we'll have a discussion on this topic, you know, unpacking this kind of hopefully very practical homework. And just a reminder that we have an important guest teacher, Lungpo Sumedho or Ajahn Sumedho, really one of the most senior Western monks, be coming on May 22nd. And thank you for your continued support of SIMS and the teachers. So have a wonderful evening, and I hope to see you next week.